Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court. God save the United States and the honorable court.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is the Estate of Boyne against the Holy Land Foundation. Mr. Boyd.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Honorable members of the court, my name is John Boyd, and I represent the Holy Land Foundation in this case. I will address one or two issues, if I have time, related to the Holy Land Foundation and the issue of intent that the court raised in its notice granting rehearing. And Mr. Pierce will address the issue of causation. The Boyms have alleged in both of their complaints that the Holy Land Foundation raised funds for Hamas, gave that money to Hamas for use in terrorist acts, and that the money was used for, among other things, the murder of David Boyne. Guns, bullets, training. The plaintiffs allege that the funds for terrorism by Holy Land, that part of Holy Land's bad behavior, alleged bad behavior, was that they commingled the funds for support of terrorism with legitimate charitable dealings so that they could be siphoned off from those legitimate funds to terrorist activities. The plaintiffs explicitly disclaimed any intent to try to hold Holy Land Foundation liable for its humanitarian efforts. Below, after extensive discovery, Holy Land Foundation put before the court, in the record, sworn statements, documentary evidence establishing that it had never provided any funds whatsoever to Hamas for charity or for terrorism. They simply had not done it, what they were accused of. The Boynes were able to produce no evidence to respond to Holy Land Foundation's listed statements, numbered statements of undisputed material fact. The court below, the magistrate court, for reasons that he did not make clear, when we pointed out in our reply on our cross motion for summary judgment that they had failed to respond to our motion for summary judgment with any numbered points identifying the evidence that would be sufficient to dispute Holy Land Foundation's evidence, simply relieved them of the opportunity to do so. The Boyms had filed a motion claiming or asserting that it had been through inadvertence that they had failed to respond to the Holy Land Foundation's numbered points of uncontested issues of material fact, and asked leave of court to file a supplement in order to correct that mistake. And the court simply, in its minute order, relieved them of that obligation before trial. So as the record stands now, it is at a minimum, established that there is at least a question of fact, if not that it is undisputed that the Holy Land Foundation did not do what it is accused of in this complaint, in the Boyms complaint. With that as background, as the court is aware, I'm sure, the district court, instead of addressing these facts that were put in the record by the Holy Land Foundation and discussing whether they were or were not actually uncontested and whether or not there should be a response, simply entered summary judgment against the Holy Land Foundation based on a theory of collateral estoppel arising from the district court and court of appeals decisions in the District of Columbia. I'm not going to address at any length here, unless the court has questions, the issue of collateral estoppel, because I think the briefs make clear that the application of collateral estoppel in this case is completely unjustified under any reading of the law of collateral estoppel. I will now move to the issue of the court's question regarding intent.
Before you reach that, I want to ask a question about what you are and are not arguing. The question the court posed, and many of the issues that are discussed in the brief, suppose that there is a private right of action for damages under this statute against donors as well as against the terrorists. Are you contesting that supposition at this point?
We do not contest that a donor who gives money to a terrorist organization intending that or with knowledge that, and that's the subtle issue before the court, I think, knowledge and intent, assuming that whatever those elements are met, and whatever this court decides those elements are met, no, we don't contest that, as long as there's causation and the other elements of tort law, mm-hmm. of generally right. applicable tort law are met.
Right, so now we arrive at the extra question the en banc court posed.
Yes, Your Honor, and I'm not going to belabor what's already in our brief. I think the two theories of recovery, aiding and abetting and conspiracy, both of those theories, it is black letter law that those are intentional torts and that they require a finding of intent.
Intent to do what?
I would say intent to provide money to a terrorist organization for terrorism of the type that results in the harm to the plaintiff. We do not contend that there's any requirement for a specific intent to harm this particular plaintiff or that.
That's not the way intent is usually understood in tort law. Intent is usually a volitional act that the actor knows or should know creates a risk of some sort. How big the risk has to be, that's a separate question. You don't have to intend to injure anybody or harm anybody. You just have the volitional act. That's pretty basic tort law.
Well, I understand what Your Honor's saying, and I think Your Honor is raising the issues that the court addressed in Fountain and Ortega, which is, sometimes, and I would agree with Your Honor, sometimes the issue of intent is something that, given the nature of the act, is really kind of beside the point. The example I think given in one or the other of those cases, and I don't remember which, is of the man who's told, I want a gun to go and kill my wife. Will you give
me
a gun?
No.
And
no.
He gives him the gun.
Here's a standard tort case. This is a famous old English tort case. An English newspaper wrote an article, which it thought was a fictitious article, about an imaginary person named Artemis Jones. And it said that Artemis Jones had been seen with a woman who was not his wife. Well, it turned out, unbeknownst to the newspaper, there was an Artemis Jones. In fact, he was a lawyer. And people who knew him thought it was a truthful article about him. So he sued for libel, and he won. So, we still have that defamation by fiction. So the deliberate act, the intentional act, is just publishing an article, you know. But if there's a risk that it's going to harm a person, which there was, then you're liable. And there is this, you know, there's a separate issue about causality and how large, which is how great must the risk be. But as far as intentionality is concerned, you don't have to talk about conspiracy or aiding and abetting or anything like that. It's just the intentional act coupled with the risk of harm, which materializes.
Well, I guess I'm not sure I disagree with Your Honor in the defamation context.
Well, all right, we can talk about battery. We can talk about, you know, Garrett versus Daly, a 5-year-old child visiting some adults. There is an arthritic woman is trying to sit down in a lawn chair, and the little kid pulled the chair out and sat on it himself. Now, the court said, look, He was just a five-year-old. He didn't intend to harm her. He wasn't playing a practical joke. He was just a kid. But nevertheless, he knew, of course, he was pulling the chair out, and he knew there was a risk that she'd fall, which she did. And that was all that was required. And that's, I think that's very standard tort law. It's not esoteric.
No. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
So the analogy is, if you give money to an organization that you know or should know, which is usually all that's required, is engaged in terrorism, then you've satisfied the requirements for intent. The donation is an intentional act. And then the question is, well, you've created a risk because of the fungibility of money. Is that risk enough to make you liable?
Well, of course, and I've tried to preface everything I say in my brief and here with a statement that there's no evidence in the record that the Holy Land Foundation did that or gave any money to Hamas, period.
Okay, that's a separate issue, obviously.
I understand it's a separate issue, but I guess my response, Your Honor, would be that we're talking with Section 2333, we're not talking about standard tort law in the sense
that
Honor is...
Look, this statute is very spare, very, very, very brief. To interpret it, to apply it, you fill it out with general tort principles.
Your Honor,
It's not as if it sets forth some, special standard unknown to tort law. It's basically just creating a new tort. And what you do with issues of intent and causality and so on, that's you bring the general tort principles in and apply them, by analogy, familiar torts to this one.
Well, Your Honor, I think that while everybody seems to agree from the legislative history of the Act that it sweeps within its reach, it just subsumes tort law as a concept. And I don't disagree with that. But I think you have to consider what is the subject matter and purpose of the Act. What is the tort law being subsumed in order to accomplish? And 2333, from its legislative history and from common sense, I would submit, it was explicitly designed by Congress to stop people from engaging in terrorism. It's about stopping terrorism and the funding of terrorism. And to say that there
are if you give money to an organization that has these two tracks, the violence track and the social welfare track, you enhance its resources and you make it abler to do both the social welfare and the violence. And the real question, I think, in the case is whether if you augment the resources of a terrorist organization, and there are terrorist acts, how definite a causal link must you show between the specific donation and the specific terrorist act? That's the hard issue, I think.
Mr. Piers is going to address the issue of causation, but one thing that I think is terribly important to make clear here is that the facts will show that the charitable activities that the Holy Land Foundation engaged in were through local charity committees in Palestine that were certified to receive funds, USAID funds, were supported by the Red Cross, the United Nations, CARE, and other organizations like that. And the only reason that the Holy I won't even speculate now as to why, under these circumstances, Holy Land Foundation should have to struggle with this idea that somehow, by engaging in charitable efforts in Palestine, where every penny can be accounted for, it all went to food, clothing, shelter, medical supplies, housing, libraries, where it all went for things like that, that Holy Land Foundation is now having to fend off a theory
terrorism. Sure, but there's a difference between organizations like the Red Cross or Doctors Without Borders that are engaged in sort of general humanitarian activities worldwide and so on. No one would think that it was, their mission to support a particular particular organization, particular movement. That's a difference, isn't there?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so. Unless you're saying that everybody can support these organizations except Islamic charities, if that's the rule, then certainly that's something that the Holy Land Foundation should have been told about from the beginning, not now, after the fact. But the fact is that these charitable entities have received USAID and CARE and UN funds not just before and during Holy Land Foundation's charitable projects with these same committees that form the basis for these allegations regarding its charitable conduct, but afterwards.
Well, so you, would you acknowledge then that if a if an organization set its set as its mission to assist Hamas social welfare activities, period, and they send money to Hamas, that they would not be guilty of a violation?
If they set about to assist Hamas, let's put it this way, I think. For purposes of the hypothetical of them actually giving money to Hamas, which is the allegation here, which is not supported in the record. If that hypothetical were true and they simply put the money in a pot and said, here's a check for $100,000.
No, you're altering my example.
I hope you use it for charity.
No, you're altering my example. Suppose they give the money to Hamas. They say, this is just for charity. And if you don't use it for charity, you'll never get any more money from us, or we'll sue you, or you know it will be a breach of contract.
I think under the 2333, if Hamas then uses that money for terrorism, that the issue will be for the
no,
jury.
No, that's wrong. It doesn't matter what they use that money for. The point is, with additional money for social welfare. Right, from this grant, they can now allocate more resources to their terrorist activities. It doesn't mean they're going to take this money and earmark it for terrorism. They're going to have more money. So it's predictable that there's going to be, you know, more terrorist financing.
Forgive me, Your Honor, but I don't think you can take judicial notice of that.
That's wait a sec. I'm asking you a hypothetical question. I'm not talking about, I'm not asking for judicial knowledge.
If my clients were called in here to testify, they
No, answer
say,
my question. They give money. They give money to for just the social welfare activities, and that's contractually limited to that. But of course, the fact is that Hamas now will have larger resources, and that will enable them if they want. To engage in more terrorist activity. If that's all we know, would that be enough to make the donor liable under the statute?
I would say no.
Well, I disagree with you.
Well, I can't imagine that
because that's a case that sounds to me a lot like, you know, a pollution case. Suppose you have a bunch of polluters and they dump toxic wastes into a lake and all the fish die and a fisherman's business is destroyed and he sues all the polluters. You know, it might be impossible to prove what causal contribution each of the polluters had made, but you could sue them all and they would be jointly and severally liable because you'd say, well, there's more pollution. And similarly, if you give money to a terrorist organization, you can earmark it all you want, but it's augmenting the resources of the organization, and the greater the resources of some organization like Hamas or Al-Qaeda, the more violence they're going to be able to engage in.
Your Honor, first of all, there's no evidence that Holy Land Foundation did that.
I'm not talking about evidence. I asked you a hypothetical question, right? You have to answer the hypothetical question.
All right. I'm trying to, Your Honor. If Your Honor is correct, that would constitute a violation, assuming that...
I'm asking you a question. I'm not asking you to add premises to my question. I gave you the facts.
My answer is no, I don't think it would. If it would, then any aid delivered in Gaza today would constitute a violation of 2333 by anyone, including representatives of the United States government, because you could argue that feeding people in Gaza is somehow relieving Hamas.
No, because remember what I'm saying. It's a gift to Hamas. It is earmarked for their charitable, for their social welfare activities, but it is to Hamas. So Hamas is going to take credit. It's going to distribute this money and say, you're getting money from Hamas.
I don't think that's, I mean, I would still say not 2333, because that involves an intent to be involved in the commission of terrorist acts.
You're wrong about intent. You don't require that level of intent for a tort. All you have to know is have some sense. You should know there's a consequence to what you're doing.
Is it foreseeable?
And that's a jury question, absolutely, if the other elements are met. And in this case...
What are the other elements?
I'm sorry?
What are the other elements? You go back to intent?
That you gave money to Hamas.
Oh, sure. That's...
And that there is a sufficient causative link between your donation to Hamas and the death of the plaintiff. Certainly...
What's required for the link?
Excuse me?
What's required for the causal link?
If I can defer that to Mr. Pierce, I will. But the other thing I want to say, and I realize my time is up, if I must make one concluding comment.
We'll give you one more minute.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Is that if all of the cases, humanitarian law and the other cases that have addressed the First Amendment implications of 2333 and 2339B have come to the conclusion that if you are supporting I've lost my train of thought there for a moment, but I'm back to it now. That the reason they don't violate the First Amendment is because you are regulating conduct unrelated to charitable efforts, to First Amendment protected efforts. If you start saying your theory of recovery under 2333 is you engaged in charity and therefore you have liability, you engaged in charity in the West Bank and Gaza, and therefore you have liability for the death of David Boehm. Now, you finally do, in fact, raise the First Amendment issue because the courts, as has been briefed in this case, have clearly decided in a number of occasions that the First Amendment protects charitable efforts. It does protect them. It doesn't protect support of terrorism, and we have never said that it does.
Thank you, Mr. Boyd.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Mr. Pierce, I'd like to ask you the same question I asked Mr. Boyd.
Yes, sir.
Is your client contesting at this point the proposition that there is a private action for damages under 2333 against donors to terrorist groups?
It is not.
Thank you.
Members of this honorable court, my name is Matthew Pierce, and I represent Mohammed Salah. As Mr. Boyd indicated to you, we have divided the argument this morning so that I will be addressing the question of causation in fact. We are before you today on a case that has been pending in the courts for some 8 years now, and as to which I respectfully submit to you, there is no evidence that the defendants did anything that contributed to or caused the tragic death of David Boehm. The court has asked the parties to address the question of intent. We adopt the comments and the briefs of our co-defendants, and I would like to address the question of causation. In part, I do so because with regard to my client, the question of intent, however it be defined, Judge Posner and members of the panel, members of this court, has no real bearing on Mohammed Salah's situation because for purposes of this appeal, due to his assertion of the Fifth Amendment in the proceedings below, it is given in this case for purposes of this appeal, that he aided Hamas in January of 1993 with intent to further the violent activities of Hamas. And the negative inference that arises with regard to that comes from his assertion of the Fifth Amendment, when asked questions with regard to his activities. It is not, however, determinative, the question of intent, with regard to either Mr. Salah or, frankly, any of the defendants that are appearing before you in this case. And that is because there is no evidence of causation. There is no evidence that anything, that any of these defendants did played a
role. Well, what would you require as minimal evidence of causation case like this?
Judge Posner, I don't know that I can answer the question of minimal evidence. I would look to the standards, all of the parties in this case.
Well, I don't know why you can't answer my question. What's the minimal evidence to prove causality in a case like this?
I'm sorry that I'm incapable of telling you what the minimum is. I can tell you what the standards are, and I can tell you.
No, because the standards are just, you know, legal jargon. So I want to know, you know, concretely, what would you accept as a minimal showing? Would there have to be a, you know, Katyusha rocket with the name Salah engraved on it, something like that? Would his contribution have to be earmarked for a specific weapon or ammunition, which then is traced to, you know, David Boyne? The bullet is, you know.
Your hypotheticals would go far beyond what I would consider to be minimal evidence.
Okay, fine. What is your conception of minimal evidence in a case
Such
like
evidence
this?
Evidence that a reasonable jury.
No. Something concrete.
That payments of money went into a pool of money out of which, at a reasonable period of time thereafter, Hamas withdrew funds and used those funds in some way to further the murder that's at issue in this case.
Okay, well, it's in some way to further. That's the sensitive part of your answer. I could understand you're saying if they enlarge the pool of money that Hamas assigns to terrorist activities, and later Boehm is killed, I can understand if you said, yeah, that'll suffice. But you're obviously requiring more. So I wonder what the more is.
I can't answer it as a general matter because I think...
No, I want you to answer it as a specific matter. Suppose Salah gives $1,000 to Hamas, and he says, I want you to use that for terrorism. And now... And then Hamas does something with the money. Now, what does it have to do? Must that money be traced into the gun used to kill Boehm or into the training of the murderers or something like that? Is that what you want to require?
Under the Halberstam standards, I think so.
Yeah, but then, you know, there's never going to be a case, right? Because that's not how things work. You don't have a specific bullet that's, you know, going to be assigned to. It's not as if Salah is going to give the money to Hamas and say, look, I want proof that this money was used to buy a weapon or conduct training that actually killed a person, right? They're not going to do that kind of earmark. It goes into a pool. Out of the pool comes money spent for various things. You can never trace the critical expenditure on the weapon that kills the plaintiff's decedent to a specific donation.
The practical difficulty of proving a claim under 2333, I don't think, determines its proper application.
Well, I disagree with you, because what you're saying is that, at least so far as the donation liability under the statute is completely ineffectual. There can never be a case.
I don't believe it's completely ineffectual. It may be ineffectual in the context of this case.
No. Where would it be effective? What would be a good example?
Well, it's entirely possible that you would have direct evidence with regard to how money was used.
No, you wouldn't. No.
Could I ask a different question? It seems to me that part of the question before us today is whether we need to revisit what this Court has now said twice in opinions, which is what we've said in the past is it's not enough to show funding alone. And as I read the briefs of the United States, amicus curiae, the United States has agreed with that position. But then the difficulty is that to make the statute mean something, what else do you need? You know, what's the plus if it's funding plus? And if you can't come up with a plus, maybe you're taken back to what Judge Posner is arguing, which, as I understand him, is a funding alone is enough. As soon as you give money to anybody who's in any way affiliated with Hamas, you've already crossed the line.
Judge Wood, there is a common law of torts of hundreds of years of experience that this court and many others have, and there are standards that those courts articulate, and those standards may not be able to provide you with a perfect roadmap in every case. That is what juries and jury instructions are for.
Yeah, but what are you going to ask the jury? I mean, trying to sit down and articulate, to tell plaintiffs what they need to prove, to tell district courts what they need to instruct those juries, you need to say something. And what we said before was funding plus the intent, not just the intent to pay the money, that collapses into funding, but intent to give money to somebody who is engaged in terrorist activities some of the time, it doesn't have to be all the time, and knowledge. But if funding, intent, and knowledge aren't right, then we need something else. We can't just say throw it to the jury. There have to be instructions. And if you had to sit down and write those instructions, what would they say?
They would say, did the party defendant aid the performance of a wrongful act which caused injury? Was the party defendant generally aware at the time of his conduct that he played a role in the part of the overall illegal or tortious activity at the time he provided the assistance? And did the defendant knowingly and substantially assist the principal violation? Take the facts presented by the parties, apply them to these standards, which are the District of Columbia's standards in the Halberstam
case. But can you be more specific about aid and assist?
Can I be more specific, I'm sorry, about aid
about
and assist?
The words aid and assist that you used.
I think that they would be fact-specific, and it could include money.
And it's fine with you. I mean, you agree that it really just has to be money that goes into the pool from which Hamas or whomever, Hezbollah, whatever the next case is, might withdraw that money and use it for... We surely cannot require proof that it goes all the way down to the killing of the particular person who was the victim.
Nobody articulates that you nobody takes the position in this case, and I see that my time is up, but let me answer your question. Nobody articulates and takes the position in this case that the dollar bill or the $10,000 or $100,000 has to be traced. I don't think anybody has ever disputed that if it goes into the terrorism pot and the tortious conduct meets the standards that the D.C. Circuit has articulated, which would include, among other things, one of the things you would measure is the time factor. Is it reasonably foreseeable? Because in addition to causation in fact, of course, you must have proximate causation. The act must be reasonably foreseeable. And at some point in the future, your contribution can no longer be reasonably foreseeable.
And that's your primary argument about your client, that it was January 93 and that was just too long before?
It's one of many. We also argue that there is no proof in this case that Hamas killed this young man. There is no proof in this case.
That's a separate issue. That's a separate issue. That's not the difficult. The difficult causational issue is what Judge Wood asked. It's tracing is not required, but expanding the pool is not enough. And then the question is, what next? And the only thing you've mentioned is time. So what if the murder occurs, 2 months after the donation? Is that enough? Or?
Depending on the overall facts, it could
be. What are the other facts?
The relationship of the party, whether the donation is given with knowledge.
We've been through all that. You said he intends to support the terrorist activities of Hamas. That's the intent issue.
There are six standards articulated in Halberstam, which are fact-specific standards.
Okay, what are the facts besides the interval?
I just want to call the court's attention. My time is up, but I'm answering the court's question.
You can always continue answering the court's questions.
No, I understand. The six standards articulated are, I have them on notes right here.
Well, that's all right. I don't want to extend the argument. We can look it up.
Could I just ask a question, just to follow up, just because I'm trying to get a concrete handle on what the elements are as well. So if you had a known terrorist organization, receives millions of dollars every year from persons who want to support the terrorist activity, so we got the funding and we have the support, What is, you know, can any terrorist act then, after that donation is made, qualify under this act?
I do not think so.
So how do you determine, besides time, I mean, it's kind of following up on what Judge Posner said, what are the other factors that we have to look at?
The single most important factor, and I apologize for being insufficiently wise to be able to answer this in a factual basis as a general matter. I'm a trial lawyer primarily. The single most specific factor is there evidence that the contribution, be it $1 or $1 million a year, substantially assisted the principal violation? And that could come in many forms, and it could indeed, as Judge Posner has pointed out, be in many cases impossible to prove.
Now, I have one question. In answering Judge Wood, you mentioned that the in proving a case like this, they would have to show that the money went to the, in your words, the terrorist pot. But if an organization does two things instead of one, why would you have to prove that it goes into one rather than the other?
You would have to prove in the scenario that the difficult case, of course, was what Judge Posner, I think, was asking my colleague, Mr. Boyd, and that is, if it goes to charity, is there still a basis of liability? And I think that the answer is it would be difficult but not impossible to conceive of such a thing, but you would have to know something about the accounting, frankly, of the two arms of this organization, because it's entirely possible that money given.
So are you saying that if Hamas kept records where the money went, this went for charity and this went for bombs, that you'd have to have something like that to establish liability? Not that the money just went to Hamas and they happened to put it here or there or wherever.
I'd be doubtful that there were records, but there could well be knowledgeable expert testimony regarding the use and expenditures of money within an organization such as Hamas. And if the money for charity goes solely to amplify the charity, I don't see how the aiding and abetting standards or the conspiracy standards are met as a matter of the common law of torts. I just don't. Thank you very much, members of the court.
Thank you, Mr. Pierce. Mr. Lewin.
May it please the court, with the court's permission, I will address the cause and fact issue presented by the panel's ruling and the question raised by the court's order relating to proof of intent. Mr. Landis will address issues concerning the factual record, including whether Hamas is responsible for the murder of David Boehm and the effect of the proceedings initiated by the Holy Land Foundation in the Federal Court for the District of Columbia. But let me just at the outset, since Mr. Boyd began with this proposition, just respond to the misleading assertion that there was some failure on the part of the plaintiffs to move for summary judgment on a substantial record in the district court. In fact, the plaintiffs moved for summary judgment, including a detailed evidentiary record and a numbered Rule 56.1 statement. HLF responded with a cross motion and a Rule 56.1 statement. The plaintiffs had inadvertently not included the response to the Holy Land Foundation's Rule 56.1 statement. That was the only inadvertence, not a failure to move for summary judgment. It received permission from the district judge to supplement the record with a response to the 56.1 statement. The response, in fact, largely referred to the Boehm's own 56.1 statement. There was enormous amounts of evidence presented to the district court in support of the initial motion for summary judgment. So that's apart even from the collateral estoppel issue, just to clarify what the record was in the district court. Now, this case was begun in May of 2000, before the cataclysmic attack of September 11, 2001. Now, more than 8 years have followed of bitterly contested litigation, and the question is whether a civil remedy that Congress fashioned in 1991 to shift to financiers of international terrorism the financial harm suffered by American victims of such terrorism can be implemented by the American judicial system.
Mr. Lewin,
we submit that the decision of the panel, which was 2 years in gestation, will, if implemented, prove that resourceful lawyers invoking procedural and substantive rules developed for domestic litigation can frustrate the critical national need to, in Congress's words, deter money raising in the United States and interrupt and imperil the flow of money to terrorist organizations.
Does it matter if I guess there are two ways you can look at this, and perhaps you can shed some light on the question. One way to look at it is that money was given by the various defendants to an umbrella organization, I'll call it, essentially Hamas, with the thought that it would go to certain activities of Hamas, and we all understand about fungibility of money. The other possible way of looking at it, which is what Mr. Boyd was more or less arguing, is that the various defendants gave money to the XYZ charity, perhaps not knowing that there was a Hamas affiliation. Not every charity, presumably, in the Middle East is affiliated with Hamas. Some are, some aren't, I would suppose. And so then the question is, if that's what were shown, if there was no knowledge that there was an affiliation between the donee and Hamas, is it still true under your view of 2333 that liability follows?
Our view is knowledge that the recipients are affiliated with or are really fronts for a terrorist organization, even though they purport to be charitable, is sufficient. And that
okay,
is because...
Okay, so they have to... So in other words, you agree that one element... I'm trying to get this down so that we actually know in this case what has to be proved. So you would agree that one thing that has to be proved is the knowledge of the donor organization, that the donee has some affiliation with the terrorist organization. So if the donee is the XYZ charity, then you'd have to have some showing that the donor knew that XYZ charity is, as you put it, maybe a front for Hamas, maybe, you know, affiliated with, whatever, that it's linked to Hamas.
Correct.
How did you show that?
The donee in these cases, Judge Wood, and this is in the district court's opinion, a list of donees, not the American Red Cross.
No, they
not
were donors,
Doctors Without
too.
Borders, but the Ramallah Zakat Committee, the Janine Zakat Committee, the Orphan Care Association in Bethlehem, the Kalkilia Zakat Committee.
Yeah, but what if it is known that the Red Cross treats terrorists? Is that enough to make Red Cross liable?
The district court in this case, after listing these particular recipients, said that all of these organizations are either known fronts for Hamas, known supporters of
Hamas.
Yes, I know.
That's
but
not
I'm
Judge
asking
Posner's
a
question.
Different question. I'm concerned about some of the amicus curiae briefs. I think raised a good question. How do we distinguish these organizations, defendants, from any, you know, sort of humanitarian organization, Red Cross, Doctors Without Borders, that may find themselves in a situation where they are treating, providing medical assistance to terrorists. Or in case of the Red Cross, they may be interviewing people in prison who are members of terrorist organization. This is giving, you know, aid and comfort to terrorism. But presumably, you know, we would have to have some principle distinguishing them from the other, other suppliers of assistance to these organizations.
And our position is that if the Holy Land Foundation had gone into Gaza and had dealt directly with people in hospitals or with various needed recipients of charity, we wouldn't be here.
So you think the intermediary committee makes a difference? So it's legal to go directly to the streets and teach a child how to read, but it's illegal to find a committee in Gaza that's teaching children how to read and give them money.
If that committee is a known front or aligned with Hamas.
You just said a few minutes ago.
They know. But the point that I think the court has to understand is that the expert testimony in this case established that these charitable committees not only were being used in order to assist Hamas generally, but the charities themselves and the activities themselves support terrorism because the schools don't teach simply arithmetic and history. They teach the basic propositions that lead to suicide bombers and to terrorism.
What about Mr. Boyd's statement that some of the recipients that his client was supporting receive USAID funds? Is that the U.S. government supporting terrorism?
No, because until the U.S. government made a determination that they were a front for Hamas, the U.S. government, like the rest of the world, may have thought that they were simply neutral beneficiaries.
And have you traced the timing on all of these things?
The evidence in this case established that back from 1989 and in 1991, before the federal government and the federal bureaucracy made a decision, a very considered decision regarding various charities, these defendants knew that these organizations were being used for Hamas and being used to assist Hamas terrorism, even though they were, on their surface, apparently charitable. Charities are not totally neutral, necessarily, politically. And consequently, if the court looks at this list, and it's important to look at the list that the record established and that I've pointed the court to in the opinion of the district court, because that's not a list of charities that one would ordinarily think of as being sort of Red Cross or hospital types. These defendants, the record shows, knew that these charities were being used to further Hamas's ends.
So can I cut to the chase and say your view is that liability is established when two things are shown. One, the donor gives funds to an organization, and two, the donor knows that that organization is affiliated with Hamas. Does anything else have to be proven in your view?
Yes, of course.
What else?
For aiding and abetting, which is our basic proposition, the decision in Halberstam and Welch, which is surprising that the panel didn't even cite or discuss in its most recent opinion, the decision in Halberstam and Welch says that for aiding and abetting, there were various considerations. You don't just take in everybody who has contributed money to one of these charities that the district court listed. You've got to do it over a substantial period of time. It's got to be the nature of the kind of conduct. These are organizations that were holding fundraising activities for these Hamas fronts. They were not simply saying, okay, we're going to give some money to the Hamas front or an individual contributor. They were engaged in the very active propagation of, frankly, the credo of terrorism. By saying we're going to invite the Hamas people in, they speak behind a mask at a convention. I mean, these are all facts that are in the record, which I won't go into right now. Mr. Landis is going to discuss some of them. But the fact is that the record established that these defendants very knowingly engaged in public activities and others that were designed to support Hamas and purported to be giving the money only to the charities. But as Judge Posner has pointed out, and as many cases do, money is fungible. By giving the money to the charities, they knew that they were freeing up money that Hamas was able to use. And indeed, they gave money directly to families of suicide bombers, which was an encouragement to further suicide bombing. They gave money directly to the Hamas leaders who were expelled by Israel, and they were known to be Hamas leaders for their benefit when they were expelled. There's ample evidence
but
in this
let me come back to the Red Cross problem.
Pardon?
The Red Cross problem. Suppose the defendants gave exclusively to the Red Cross or the Red Crescent, and they file an affidavit in the litigation saying, the reason I gave to the Red Cross is because they provide humanitarian aid to everybody, including terrorists, and I thought by doing that I would free up resources for Hamas. Would that be a basis of civil liability?
I don't think it would be a basis for civil liability under 2333, Judge Easterbrook. I think that under those circumstances, donors to the Red Cross.
But why would there be a difference? If the theory is that by giving to Hamas's humanitarian arm, it frees up resources for the military arm, why is that any different than if you give to the Red Cross in order to free up resources for Hamas's military arm?
This laps over a little bit into the court's second question, because intent, we submit, is not really the issue. You can have the worst intent. You can decide you want to support terrorism. But if you engage in activity and in conduct which is very neutral, you're contributing to the Red Cross. But the reason I'm contributing to the Red Cross is I want to help terrorism. That is not necessarily a basis for liability under 2333. 2333, as Judge Posner said, is a very sparse statute. It is very simple.
I think you're distinguishing between motive and intent. The intent is to give to the Red Cross. The motive could be anything. Could be like the color red.
Mm-hmm.
I'll accept that distinction, Judge Posner. I assume that from what Judge Easterbrook was asking, that he was saying, look, if a motive is to help terrorism, will that invalidate it? And to that extent, I would amend my answer by saying that the motive then becomes irrelevant because the conduct itself is not maybe subject to the statute. But the statute says...
Now, my concern, I should be clear, if it wasn't clear from the questions I asked earlier, you know, I just can't see anything in 2333 providing for liability of donors to any organization. There are three statutes, 2339 A, B, and C, that have to do with liability of donors. They're much more carefully restricted. They specify what organizations are liable, who the right plaintiff is, and using 2333 to evade all of the limitations in very carefully drafted statute seems to me problematic. It leads to questions like this. But given the answers of the defendants, that question is off the table here. But I think you can see the problems of just treating 2333 as an opportunity for plaintiffs to evade the limitations that are deliberately built into the three statutes addressing this question.
Well, Judge Easterbrook, all I can say, apart from the concession that's been made here in this court, is that the legislative history of 2333 is entirely clear that Congress intended to cut off fundraising in the United States. It was not limiting the lawsuit to Mr. Hinawi and Mr. al-Sharif, who killed David Boyne. It said that anybody injured by reason of an act of international terrorism. Now, the panel, in its opinion, and the appellants in this court keep saying, well, by reason of an act of international terrorism shows that causation is required. It doesn't. All that it shows is that the harm has to be caused by an act of international terrorism. David Boyne was killed by an act of international terrorism. The question is, are the aiders and abettors and the conspirators who participated in the killing of David Boyne, are they liable? And we submit, Judge Easterbrook, that in light of the legislative history, it's entirely clear that people who finance the organization, whether they directly intended to finance terrorism or finance related organizations, would be held liable.
Well, how far back along the chain of monetary transfers would a donor be liable? What would be the limit on liability arising from those donations?
Certainly, let me preface that by saying that on this record, there can't be any doubt about the fact that over an extended period of time, the Holy Land Foundation and the other defendants didn't just put in one or two contributions. they extended it over a substantial period of time. And Halberstam and Welch makes a big point about that, that to be an aider and abettor, the extended period of time is substantial.
The timing and the number of donations. What about the donors' degree of certainty that the organization engaged in terrorist practices, especially if there's no specific intent requirement?
The standard is for a plaintiff who's simply trying to recover for the damage that was caused to the plaintiff. This, again, is not a criminal case. This is a civil case. Who bears the loss? Is it Joyce and Stanley Boehm for the murder of David Boehm, or is it these defendants? For that purpose, the standard is a preponderance of the evidence. All that has to be shown is that it's more likely than not that these defendants had in mind or knew that the recipient was a Hamas-associated organization. Summary judgment was granted in this case because the evidence was overwhelming. But in terms of the period of time, it's the Halberstam and Welch standard. That's in terms of what is an aider and abettor. And in Halberstam and Welch, the court held that somebody who I think was far more removed and less likely to see the consequence of what happened could be held liable as an aider and abettor. Let me just say,
I'm puzzled by the emphasis both sides placed on Halberstam. I don't see how a decision of the panel of the D.C. Circuit is binding on the Seventh Circuit en banc.
It's not binding, Judge Easterbrook, but the Supreme Court said in the Central Bank case that
the Supreme Court said in Central Bank that this whole branch of liability doesn't exist, that there is no aiding and abetting liability in violation
of federal statute. But nonetheless, it was apparently...
But this point has been conceded by your adversaries.
But the Halberstam opinion was approved by the Supreme Court, and I can only say
that... It was rejected by the Supreme Court. The whole basis of liability acknowledged in Halberstam was rejected in Central Bank of Denver.
Because in that case... That, as the court said the first time in Boehm 1, because that was a statutory liability case where you could
but
not
why would you go the aiding and abetting
the common law principles, I think,
I don't understand your emphasis on aiding and abetting. It's not a tort concept. It's mentioned in tort cases occasionally, but it's not. It's a criminal concept. Requires much more proof than for civil liability. I don't know why. Just because there's a case out there, I don't know why it goes there.
Well, Judge Posner, we...
A conspiracy. What is that?
Aiding and abetting, conspiracy, the fact that around Mr. Marzouk...
But why? I mean, this is a standard tort case where you have, as I said, Mr. Boyd, you have a volitional act... And you have a consequence or a risk, and the question is how big the risk is. Whereas for aiding and abetting, you have to, want to advance the goals of a criminal, and want him to succeed in his criminal activities, which is not necessary in tort law.
Frankly, the reason, Judge Posner, is that the statute talks about the injury by reason of an act of international terrorism. The act of international terrorism was the murder of David Boehm.
Yeah, that's the murder, but you don't have to be an aider and abettor in order to be liable civilly for some bad consequence, right? I mean, if a hotel, for example, fails to exercise due care to protect its guests, and as a result, someone comes in and murders a guest, the hotel is liable. That's not aiding and abetting. It's just negligence liability, right? So
that's negligence liability.
Right.
The problem, Judge Posner, is that this is a deliberate, intentional
sure.
act.
Yeah, but,
and the question is how
right.
do you make
but of
somebody
course,
else
but
liable
you
for
no,
an intentional
but
act?
But look, there's more liability for the consequences of intentional than negligent acts. The point is, if you don't need aiding and abetting to hold some hotel liable because it didn't have an adequate TV surveillance system inside, you can certainly hold liable someone who gives money to an organization knowing that this money may end up being used to commit violent acts.
Well, I'll accept that proposition, Judge Posner, although I think that if one applies common law principles of aiding and abetting and conspiracy, which is what the panel did in the first Boehm case, and let me say, if the court looks at
I don't know why the plaintiffs have assumed the burden of proving what is essentially a criminal standard of liability in a civil case.
Well, in the first Boehm opinion, the court said that the only way to imperil the flow of money and discourage the financing of terrorist acts is to impose liability on those who knowingly and intentionally supply the funds to the persons who commit the violent acts.
Thank you, Mr. Lewin. We've read the panel.
All right. But
thank you.
My point is...
Thank you, Mr. Lewin. Your time has expired.
May I just have a minute to conclude?
Your time has expired. Mr. Landis.
Stephen J. Landis for the plaintiffs. To respond to several of the questions, we put in very substantial evidence that each of these defendants had an ongoing, consistent relationship with Hamas. The whole idea that these defendants or the Holy Land Foundation was simply a donor, I think, understates the relationship that they had with Hamas. We demonstrated through expert testimony, through the leading experts on Hamas, that, put it simply, it is not easy to get people to blow themselves up.
Because, really, wait, Mr. Landis, before you go too far down that line, I think it would be helpful, at least for me, instead of lumping all of the defendants together, there are factual differences in the way each one interacted with this. I mean, the obvious one is Salah, of course. Then you have the organizations. You've got AMS. You've got Holy Land Foundation, Quranic Literacy Institute, and so on. So maybe you could just say a word about the different ways that you think that whatever it is we think we have to prove is being proved against each defendant.
I would say that, chronologically from the beginning. The first organization that came on the scene in North America was the Islamic Association for Palestine. Khalid Mishal, and it's evidence in the case, who runs Hamas today in an interview, that's evidence in this case, said it was the first pillar of Hamas in North America. It was designed, they say, as a grassroots organization, but it wound up acting as essentially the marketing arm for Hamas. They invited notorious terrorists to come to the United States to speak at their convention, and to create what is essentially known as the Hamas Dawah, or social structure in North America. From the Islamic Association from Palestine came the Holy Land Foundation. The Holy Land Foundation, as I was beginning to say, is more than simply a donor. It is an organization that was formed by people from IAP, and the evidence of the cooperation between Holy Land and IAP in terms of going into the whole questions of knowledge and what the purpose of the donations were and what they knew can be visualized in videos that were put out of conventions of IAP where there were signage that talked about supporting Hamas, that had Sheikh Qaradawi, who got up and spoke about killing Jews, who had songs about terrorism, and putting a video out that said, support jihad, give your money to the Holy Land Foundation.
So I guess basically your theory then is that there's a lawsuit in U.S. court, if you can make the U.S. citizenship link, for every person who's ever been killed in land controlled by Hamas. Is that correct?
No, it's not.
Why not?
What we're saying is
I don't
this.
See where there's any line that crosses that at all, because if it's helped Hamas, then you can sue these people.
No, because I think that you would have to show, first of all, that Hamas killed the person in question.
Why couldn't you show that in Gaza today?
I think today in Gaza, if you had organizations in the United States that were supporting the social structure of Hamas that makes it possible for them to generate suicide bombers, you'd have the same liability
under the statute. So it's really everybody. I mean, our courts are open.
I don't know if it's everybody today because I'm not that familiar with the facts today, even though I know there are laws against sending money to Gaza. We're talking about a period of time In the late 80s and early 90s, when Hamas was a fledgling institution, and the support of funds from the United States was very critical to the success of Hamas, and these organizations that are the defendants in this case were instrumental in creating a fundraising mechanism in the United States that allowed the social structure of Hamas to flourish, and that social structure of Hamas brought about the types of people like Hadawi and Sharif who killed David Boyne. That's our theory, and it's supported by expert testimony in this case that was never controverted by anybody.
There's like Paz and those people you're talking about?
Well, Ruben Paz, who is a leading expert on terrorist organizations, a scholar, also was a very senior intelligence officer in Israel, and also by Matt Levitt, who I think has written the definitive book on Hamas that was published last year, and very much his expert report is what went into the book. And the point they make is that what they call the Hamas Dawah, the social structure, that trains and educates people and inculcates this belief of death, which is in the Hamas charter, which was itself circulated by these two defendants, Holy Land and IAP, makes it very clear that if you have a link to Hamas, if you're giving them money, you are inevitably supporting a social structure that is centered upon suicide bombing and terrorism. And we believe...
But you're saying that any American citizen who was killed in the Gaza Strip by Hamas would have a cause of action.
Well, I think would have a cause of action against people who are supporting, knowingly supporting Hamas institutions. And I think that is what the statute was designed to prevent. The people should but here I think it's somewhat different because our argument with a common link not only of these organizations with each other, but their common link to Musa Abu Marzouk, who is today a senior Hamas official in Damascus, who was sent here to organize these defendants, provided a common link and I think underlies very much our conspiracy theory. And I think it's important I understand the analogies for today, but it was much different in the early 90s and late 80s when they came to the United States and were raising substantial sums. And then, we point to various pieces of evidence in our principal brief and our supplemental brief that show this ongoing direct support for Hamas institutions. The fact is that the identification of these institutions was never contested in this case and were never contested seriously in the D.C. case. I know that that's an issue.
What if someone just gave money to a hospital in Gaza?
Well, I think
knowing that most of the people or many of the people treated there would be, members of Hamas, members of the armed wing of Hamas.
I think that would be obviously a different case than this one. I think that the border here between what we'd call funding simpliciter, I want to help poor people, right?
I want to help poor people in Gaza.
But say in 1996, if I had to help poor people in Gaza, if I was just a person who was giving a contribution, maybe I had some idea that this was Hamas. But the point we're making
No. You just give. There's no Hamas in this. I'm just giving money to a hospital in Gaza. A hospital has nothing to do with Hamas. But they treat everybody, including injured fighters of Hamas, fighting with Fatah, fighting with Israel, what have you. And they know that. So we'll forget about their motives or anything. They're giving money to a hospital. But the hospital is going to be assisting Hamas. So is that enough for liability? If it's not, what's the line? That's troublesome to some of us.
Well, I think the line may be a consistent pattern of donation with some relationship to the people that are managing the hospital, that it's not just simply a gift.
Okay, they give it to the management. But suppose the management are just people who, they're just interested in hospitals. They're not interested. They don't care who's being treated. Just some rich person gives money to a hospital.
I would say that a person under the statute who is giving money to a hospital that he knows, has reason to believe, is acting essentially as the medical corps for Hamas.
No. You keep changing. I'm not talking. Suppose you have some rich American who gives money to any hospital in a third world country or, third world situation. You write him, you want money for your hospital, he gives you the money for the hospital. He knows that if he writes a check to a hospital in Gaza, some of the people treated there are going to be Hamas, some of them are actually going to be people wounded in terrorist activity. But he's not part of Hamas, not interested in Hamas. He's just interested in hospitals. But he knows this is going to assist Hamas in the sense that it's going to provide more medical care for their people. Is he liable under the statute?
Probably not.
How do you describe the difference?
If you would have to show that the donor had some understanding or some knowledge that this was not incidentally helping people who may be affiliated with Hamas, but was actually an institution that was...
That's awfully fuzzy, though, incidentally.
If it had happened, that we understand it's a Hamas neighborhood and we're helping it out, but if they understood that this was a Hamas institution that was managed...
No, you keep changing my facts. The hospital is not a Hamas institution, it's just a hospital. They treat everybody.
No, I would say there's no liability. I think you would have to show that they knew it was a Hamas institution.
So it would not be your position that anyone who does business with Hamas would be liable for specific acts of terror if the person knows Hamas engages in terrorist activities? So it could just be a business. Let's say you had some Hamas leaders who had a medical supply company, let's say, and someone bought products from them. They knew that they were leaders in Hamas.
Then I think you'd have a problem, because I think you would run the risk knowing that you are doing business with the people who are actually active in a terrorist organization. Then I think you would run the risk of providing indirect direct funding to Hamas or supporting Hamas institutions. I think the statute was designed to prevent the funding of terrorist organizations. I think that if you were suddenly doing business selling, even providing some, types of equipment, that you would run that risk.
So if an international aid group provides some humanitarian assistance to Hamas, knowing that Hamas engages in terrorism, it is therefore liable for any act of terrorism that Hamas might commit.
I think that if you are supporting Hamas, if you are sending them money or sending them supplies, you have the risk of being exposed to liability. That's what the statute was attempting to prevent, because Hamas operates as an integrated entity, an entity that as much supports business as it does terror, and it's even more than the fungibility of money. It's creating opportunities and creating support for terrorist organizations.
But there is no requirement of specific intent to aid Hamas's terrorist acts.
I would say that if you know you're giving money to Hamas, then you invariably are providing support for terrorism, that the intent doesn't have to be that type of specific intent.
So there's no requirement of specific intent.
I would say no, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Landis. Mr. Boyd, if you have any brief responses, I will give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you very much. Points I want that I think are important to make. First of all, with respect to the committees, Mr. Lewin said that these charity committees that the United States government didn't realize before at some point that these were affiliated with Hamas. The Treasury Department keeps a huge list of every organization and person that it believes is affiliated with terrorism. It's different than the one under 8 USC that's at issue here. It's a very long list with thousands of members, thousands of people on it. None of these charity committees has ever been on that list.
When did Treasury start keeping that list?
I think 1995, I believe. Second of all, this theory that it is the Holy Land Foundation's charitable activities that give rise to liability is not the theory that was pled in the complaint or the amended complaint. The theory that's pled in those complaints is that they gave the money to Hamas and that the money was used for bombs and bullets. We have never had to defend this case on the theory that's before the court now. The Boyms took the position in their complaint, as set forth in Boym 1, that they are not complaining about and do not seek to impose liability based on Holy Land Foundation's charitable activities. Finally, we have a record in this case
That record does not support, with anything that is even remotely admissible, what Mr. Lewin and Mr. Landis have characterized as the facts of this case. The Holy Land Foundation made a record below. They did it under oath with admissible evidence. And that record establishes that they never did what they're charged with in this complaint, ever. And it has not been rebutted.
Well, what did they do?
What did they do? They engaged in charitable projects in the West Bank and Gaza and in Turkey and in Chechnya and in Kosovo and in Oklahoma and in New Jersey and elsewhere in the world. They are and always have been a charity. And
did they have any relation with Hamas?
There are meetings that occurred at which that are in the, that are referred to in some of the documents, none of which I believe are properly authenticated. There are meetings before, years before Hamas, A, ever committed its first act of terrorism, and B, was ever designated as a terrorist organization, in which people who were supporters of Hamas were in the same room with members of the Holy Land Foundation.
When did Holy Land start to exist?
I think they started in 1988 and existed up until 2001 when the government closed them. And I will conclude by saying that as far as the government, unless the court wants me to go into detail about the collateral estoppel issue, I won't. But there are, if the court gets hung up on that language from the D.C. Circuit's opinion,
I don't think it's necessary to discuss that.
Okay.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement. The court will take a brief recess before calling the next case.